Tom Wayne, I'm an alcoholic.
Need him.
In March of 1954, Floyd B. attended his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Sacramento, California. There was only one group in Sacramento at that time. Floyd was their ninth member. After several months of sobriety, in his words, Floyd had mastered the program. He graduated and decided to celebrate. He took a drink on Christmas Day, 1944, and was drunk for 26 days. On January 20th, 1945, Floyd B. took his last drink and was sober until the day he died in February 1968. Having been sober then for a few months, Floyd decided he would like a meeting closer to home. He made plans in his mind to start a meeting in Roseville. And so, on October 5, 1945, Floyd gathered his wife, Alice, and three sober friends, Ray C., Henry D., and Lila T., together in his law office at 301 Main. And the first meeting of Roseville Tuesday Night Group was held. Of those founding members, Lila was the last to be with us. She passed away February 10, 1934. She was always an inspiration to all of us. Back in 1945, when the small group met in Floyd's office, they were the fourth AA group in Northern California. From that group, members went out, and now over 550-plus groups have been formed all over Northern California and Nevada. These groups hold more than 800 meetings weekly. And in the past years, literally thousands of suffering alcoholics have found their way to our doorsteps, to sobriety and a new way of life. We reside at 315 Lincoln Street, Old Roseville, has always been our home. Meetings are held at least twice a day, 7 days a week, a home of good sobriety and basic AA because we keep coming back. God grant it that it may always be so.
Thank you, Wayne. Wayne's suffering was about 44 years there.
My name is Susan, and I am an alcoholic. And I am really glad to be here tonight. And it's really good to see so many people show up. And for those that are asking me if I was nervous, and I kept saying no, I'm nervous. It's here. I have no idea what I'm going to say. But, I've had a lot of good people tell me, just turn this thing over, and whatever needs to be, whatever needs to come out of your mouth will come out. Make sure I don't go over here. I want to welcome everyone. And I just need to say, regarding this fellowship of Roseville Tuesday Night, we're a real family. There's people in this group that I care a great deal about. And for those that are new, or those that aren't new but maybe don't have a home group, I like highly, highly suggest it. That's one of the suggestions that was given to me when I first came in, besides don't drink and go to meetings. But they suggested that I get a home group because part of my disease was my isolation and the other part was running from people. And the booze allowed me to do that. I could hide behind, being drunk. I could hide behind the booze. And I could, I was never who I really was when I was drunk. And what I found when I had to get a home group and I started getting involved with people is that I had to let people start to see who I really was. And that was scary as hell because I didn't think you guys would like me. But it's also been the best thing that can happen. And I know that When we came to Roseville, it's been about 4 or 5 years, I guess, now. One of the ways that I got involved was getting involved with our anniversary. It was our 50th anniversary, so it was 4 years ago. And it was wonderful. You know, I just kind of suited up and showed up and, you know, made bows and hung lights and did all of that. And that's all it takes. You know, that's getting in service and getting busy. And that's what I found about this program. It's really, really simple as long as I show up and suit up and I'm willing. I don't want to go too much into my drunkalogue, but I drank alcoholically, you know, and I got to the point in my drinking where I couldn't not drink, and I had to make that decision. And I can tell you also that I didn't want to come to this program. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I also knew that this isn't where I wanted to be. I thought that accepting the fact that I wasn't an alcoholic, admitting that I was an alcoholic, was probably just about as far down as I could possibly go. I had had not a great deal of success in anything that I did in my life. You know, I had gone to school, and I was supposed to get a BA, and that fell through, and all the relationships I had in my life had fallen through, and I didn't have, my family wasn't, you know, things were, nothing was fitting, and somehow admitting that I was an alcoholic was just going to be one more tick against me. And what I have found out is that it's probably the greatest strength that I have today. Admitting that I'm an alcoholic, coming to these meetings, working these steps, and being of service. I can tell you that it didn't start to work for me until I started to work it. I spent the first year and a half of this program just doing it Susan's way. And I ended up, after about a year and a half, resentful and angry and depressed and sad and isolating one more time. And thank God I didn't have to pick up that drink again, but it was getting to that point. I didn't have a sponsor, or I had one, but it was only a name. I never called her. We didn't work a step. We didn't do anything. But, you know, it got to the point where I was tired of people saying, well, have you got a sponsor yet? And I'd say, no. And they said, well, you know. So finally I asked somebody, but it was just to get people off my back. And after about a year and a half, I asked someone to be my sponsor. Matter of fact, the person I asked to be my sponsor ended up not being my sponsor, but one of her sponsees did. And that's funny how this thing kind of works that way. And Lori and I got together every week for an hour and a half for about a year and a half, and we worked the steps. You know, we got the big book out, and we got the 12x12 out, and we did this thing. And Lori had only about 3 or 4 more months than I did. But you know what? She loved this program, and she really helped me to get into the books and helped me to understand about what being in service, because Lori was excellent with service. She was excellent one-on-one. We'd jump in the car, her and I and some other women, and we go to a meeting. We have a meeting before the meeting, and then we'd get in the car and come home. We have a meeting after the meeting. And you know, that's what I found out about this program, is that the meetings are very important. But I have to get to know you outside of the meetings, too. You know, I can't walk into the meetings and for an hour and a half be this perfect little AA person. You know, I have to be able to take these steps and go out there and in my job and in my family and in the grocery store line where I'm in a hurry and the clerk is like, you know, very slow. You know, I have to be able to work these steps. And, or when I'm driving, I come back, Jekyll and Hyde. But I have to do those things, and you people have gently and kindly taught me about this program and taught me that it's, you know, it's so much more than what I thought it was when I came into this program. I didn't know what I wanted when I came in here. All I knew is I was tired of hurting. I was tired of feeling different and separate and apart from. I was tired of not understanding why all the parts of my life wasn't working. I was just tired of being tired. And when I came into, I turned myself into the reality program down in Modesto, which is it's a county program. And I was there for 30 days. That was my first surrender. And I found out through that program, I found out about Alcoholics Anonymous, and then that's where I needed to be. And this whole deal of just one day at a time has been one surrender after another. Sometimes huge ones, sometimes little ones. But in my life, you know, the one thing that always reappears for me is my ego. And I have to, on a daily basis, do an ego deflation. You know, because my mind likes to think that I know something. And I don't, you know. You know, I've told in this program that the only thing I do have control over is my attitude, and I believe that today. You know, I don't have any control over you. I don't have any control over people, places, or things. But I do have control how I react to what happens, you know. And that's new for me. I didn't know that. I didn't know that when I came in here. I just sort of felt like a leaf on the wind, and, you know, if you said something, and I would, like, turn the other way, and I was pretty much of a people pleaser when I came in here, and pretty empty. I didn't even know when I came in here what I liked, and I mean color-wise, or, you know, just the real basic things about me. And what I've learned is that I can grow up in this program. You know, I've heard more people say to me, you know what, I'm really growing up in this program. I'm 35 years old, and I'm growing up in this program, I've heard people say, you know, and that's true. That is so true. Some things that I needed to do. One, I needed to get a home group. I needed to get into service. I get the sponsor. I needed to work the steps, you know, because I would sit around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in that first year and a half, and I'd think, how come I'm not getting this? How come you look like you're getting it? I see a twinkle in your eye, or I see, you know, you look like you're peaceful. You look like you're dealing with, you know, why can't I get this? And one more time, I thought I was terminally unique, as I still do from time to time. And all I found out, man, I just had to start getting into action. I just had to start putting one foot in front of the other. And it didn't get well and wonderful, you know. There are times when I've had to walk through, you know, deaths in the family, like we all do. I lost a job that I absolutely adored, and that turned out to be one of the hardest things that I had to go through. Because I had to let go of the job, and I had to let go of what that job defined me as, you know, and I had to learn about that. I love this program, you know, because there's nowhere else I can go when I can walk into the rooms of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I can sit down, and I heard a speaker describe it the other night, and it was so right on. It's like, I'm here. I'm here for the next hour and a half, and there's nowhere else I want to be. There's nobody else I want to be. I'm right where I need to be. And that was not my life. You know, when I was in that room, I wanted to be in that room because I was sure that's where the action was, you know. And I was never comfortable in my own skin. I always wanted to be you because your life looks so much more exciting and so much better than mine. And that was one of the miracles that happened for me when I began to realize that I was comfortable in my own skin. That I started to like who this person is, you know. I want to mention something real quickly. I'm not quite sure how long I've already talked. But I want to mention the fact the other thing that I've gotten from this program is a higher power. When I came in, I had a God that I was sure was out to get me. Because the things that I did when I was out there drinking were not things that I really thought that he was sitting up there with a big smile on his face about. about every commandment possible. And although I never really killed anybody, I physically... You know, I had to learn that I did come to kill people emotionally and mentally when I wasn't there, when I couldn't emotionally be there for them. You know, I had to take a look at a lot of my different behaviors. So I had a God that I thought was very angry at me, and I was very afraid to face him. And you people have allowed me to find another higher power. And that higher power is a friend, that higher power I talk to on a daily basis. I'll have you know he got the mic working. and that is how I truly feel. I laugh, but I, you know, there is an absolute peace and calm in my life most of the time. You know, there is insanity that comes up. But for the newcomer, you know, I want to tell you, this is a simple program. You know, and when they say just keep coming back, it means just coming back. Because every time you come back, every time I came back, I heard something else I needed to hear. One more thing. And it built and it built and it built. And let the people love you here. There's a lot of love in these rooms. You know, these people are here to reach out their hands. And the other thing is that when we reach out, we get help too. And you'll begin to understand that. You know, I love you guys. I love you, the Roseville Tuesday Night Group. I have such an honor to sponsor the women that I sponsor. You know, and I have some wonderful sponsors in my life. Some that may not know they're my sponsor, but they are. And again, I want to welcome everyone, and thank you for joining and celebrating our anniversary tonight. Thanks.
Well, that was a fantastic message, Susan. And for the next part of our program, I would have the great privilege and honor of introducing from Oakland, California, our main speaker, Father Tom W.
My name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be in Roseville tonight. Every so often I get close to Roseville in Sacramento or on my way somewhere else, and nice to stop and see faces, you know, so hello. There's visitors and newcomers and people from out of town, and I think for a lot of people it takes a while to understand how AA works. We talk about steps and traditions, and it just takes a while, though, to get deeper into finding how this group of women and men who should be dead or in jail functions a day at a time, you know? And one example, one of our traditions says, in AA we do not bring in outside controversial subjects. So we don't particularly talk about politics or alcohol reform or sectarian religion. This was in the lived experience of an awful lot of the early members, all of the battles of prohibition and are you a wet or a dry and all that stuff. Well, in the last couple of weeks in Alameda County, we had an incident where the person who was chairing the meeting wanted the topic to be, how are you handling the impeachment? I wasn't at that meeting, and I'm grateful for that, but I heard about it 10 minutes later. And this was a person who was kind of new and was having strong feelings, and whether the feelings were up or down is irrelevant. The feelings were there, and he wanted to talk about it, and some older people in the room said that the feeling in the room changed immediately because it went 45-55. Boom! Split! And someone with older sobriety had to break in and say that is not an AA topic. We don't discuss politics, for or against. We don't discuss religious stuff, for or against. And we don't talk about what we should do in terms of dope laws, booze laws. Those are outside controversial issues. We are not people who would ordinarily associate. And we have a primary purpose, and so we talk about alcohol and alcoholism and keep the other stuff outside. I was sober for a while. I come in with you know, every prejudice I still have, but I was much less yielding. And it took a while for me to realize that there is something, that there are ways of cooperating with people and ways of not cooperating with people. And the program has to be kept wide but focused. I visited in communist Poland when there were still communists, and this was, I guess, in the early 80s. And I went in through the AA connection. I met some people in Stockholm, Sweden. I was working there, and, you know, what are you going to do while I'll be in Poland? Who do you know? Nobody. Here's a phone number. And there was a group of us who my friend and I, who's both sober in the program, got off the train in one of the Polish cities like Warsaw or Poznan or Krakow, and there were five sober AA guys waiting for us, and they were told, you know, who are you looking for? Two sober Americans. That's all they knew. One of them spoke a little bit of English, a little bit, and they had an English-Polish dictionary and a big book in Polish. That's what they had. So we talked. They took care of us for a couple of days, and we talked about one of the guys, and he said there's a big problem with alcoholism in Poland, and the party was running everything. It was military government, and there was an article in one of the Communist Party dailies or monthlies about alcoholism and AA. And this was written by a Polish guy who got sober in Southern California. And it was such a big problem, they wanted some solutions, that the communist authorities ran the article about AA in the journal. And they didn't change anything. They talked about 12 steps and 12 traditions and fellowship and all that stuff and higher power, all published, and they listed some phone numbers. Now, the guy I was staying with is a man named Adam. And Adam was a member of Solidarity. And Adam had spent a couple of years in prison because of his political activities in Poland, got sober. His phone number was one of the numbers listed, and a couple weeks after the article ran, he got a phone call. And it was a high-ranking member of the military government who said he could not stop drinking. And Adam made the 12-step call on him and found out that he was making a 12-step call on the man who threw him in prison. And when we were there, Adam was that man's sponsor. And I said, how can you do that? And he said, primary purpose, and we never discuss outside controversial issues. So I just think that's one of the ways AA operates. Another way is this. If you didn't know any better, you would think that they get the people who are real well to speak at the meetings. Because that's what they do with other groups, you know, role models for countless millions. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we've discovered that that's not very effective. Because if someone has perfect mental health and speaks at a meeting, everyone else wants to shoot themselves. However, if you get a lunatic to share, everyone else relaxes immediately and says, that guy's program is crap. And you go home feeling better about yourself and your program and your sponsor. So... We who speak at AA meetings are not here as role models. We are here as warnings. That's the key. Okay. Another thing, when we talk about it, we talk about principles over personalities. You can disagree with anything I say. You don't have to leave. I don't have to leave. We can disagree on all kinds of stuff. AA is a very wide open organization, and what I had to hear was take what you need and leave the rest. I had to hear that. I have a little trouble with authority figures and a little trouble with people who try to run my life. And if I could take what I needed and leave the rest, if you really meant that, then I could stay. But if you tried to take over, I'd have to leave. So the principles, there are people with long sobriety who disagree with me on crucial issues of recovery, and they seem to lead happy lives. That bothers me more than I can tell you. I'd prefer that they disagreed with me and were miserable, you know. If you don't like what I say tonight, if you can't stand me, go to another meeting. I mean, it's that simple, you know. It's a big organization. So I've been around for a little bit. Let me give you a couple of statistics. I do live in Oakland, California. I've lived in Oakland since 1981, and that's where I go to meetings. I grew up and was born in San Jose. So I'm pretty much local, you know, Northern California type. I joined the Jesuits when I was 18 years old, and I got sober when I was 29 years old. I'd been in the Jesuit order for 11 years. I got sober when I was studying theology at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. So my first exposure to recovery is Berkeley AA, which is a unique experience. I was sober for a year, and I moved to Los Angeles to go back to work again, and I lived in L.A. for 4 years going to a zillion meetings. So I also have that experience of Southern California AA where they clap a lot. And then I moved back to Oakland. I was ordained a priest in 1979. I got sober in August of 1976. So I'm 51 years old, and I've been sober for about 23 years or 22 years, something like that. So those are just facts and figures and statistics. And I'm born in the year of the pig, and I'm an Aries, so if you want to sort through any of that. I drank and used pretty much on a daily basis. Let me talk about that just a little bit. I heard someone at a meeting say that if you're speaking at a meeting, mention alcohol. I think that's a good policy. Sometimes I don't know why people are there, you know. I'm someone who was a daily drinker. I started drinking when I was very young, and for a long time it worked. And then it no longer worked. Someone, and I don't know who this person is, they said, well, why did you drink? Because it was a sensational experience. That's why I drank it. It really helped. And it probably was the longest standing relationship I ever had. I mean, I didn't get married a lot, I drank, you know. I didn't date a lot, I drank. It just was the steady thing in my life. And when I got sober, lots of things happened, but one of the things that happened that was difficult even to talk about was I grieved alcohol's passing. It was like I had lost my best friend. And part of the confusion of my emotional life, wasn't I glad to be sober? Yeah. And didn't I miss the bottle? Yeah. You know, it didn't seem logical to me, but it sure was real. Sure was real. I started drinking when I was young enough to think that mixing bourbon and Hershey syrup was a good idea. I also like cream de mint. I like that sweet stuff out of the bottle. I like all the sugary drinks. I passed out of the sugary drink stage by the time I was in high school. But as a kid, I really liked it, which is why they invent sugary drinks, you know, like Annie Boone Springs Farm wine and, you know, chocolate with liquor inside. Who's that for? You know, I like all that. I did a lot of drunk driving. I had the typical problems with alcohol that many of us do. And by that, I mean my two biggest problems with drinking. I had a lot of blackouts, and I had a lot of mood shifts. We call those Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. If you're looking for something to read that's not program approved, may I suggest Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by by Robert Louis Stevenson. Don't read it at night alone. It's a scary book. it's written, you know, in the last century, and Dr. Jekyll's the good guy and Mr. Hyde's the bad guy, and Dr. Jekyll plays in the laboratory a little too long and drinks his own stuff and becomes a monster and becomes addicted to this. And Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde has no recovery. Mr. Hyde wins. And it's a short story. It's not a novel. If you don't have time to read the whole thing, just read the last chapter. It summarizes it. But I read this when I was about 10 years sober, and it raised the hair on the back of my neck. I identified very closely with Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I also had a pretty bad case of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, where I would drink and I could become happy or dopey or grumpy or sleepy. And occasionally I'd turn into Snow White, which surprised everybody. So I was sober just a little while, and there is so much I don't understand about life. And I got sober in Berkeley, like I said, and at this time, and this was during the Ford presidency, that far back, there wasn't really a meeting a night in Berkeley yet. Now there are, but I mean, there wasn't even one meeting a night. And so you had to leave Berkeley if you needed meetings every day. This was good for me because I hated I was a little paranoid. And I was afraid to leave the city limits of Berkeley, which shows you the condition I was in. And I had to find the El Cerrito Fellowship because there were meetings all day long in the El Cerrito Fellowship. And I would go there and find old-timers, and they were always hanging around. And I remember going up to one of them after a meeting, and he seemed a little less crusty than the others. So I said, "How do you know you're an alcoholic? How do you know you're an alcoholic?" And I was hoping he'd give me some clues, because I didn't know. I was a couple of months without a drink. There's a section in the book that we used to read all the time back in 76, 77, and it's the beginning of chapter 11, and it reads like this. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself, as we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm. That's very badly overwritten, I think, but that's not the point. The chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. I did not know if I was an alcoholic, but I knew I was an unhappy drinker. This is the first page or section of the book I identified with. Everything else is in the future and obscure and bizarre and steps and traditions and who cares. This, however, talked about some of my stuff, and I didn't identify with Bill Wilson for a long time. Now I do, but I didn't for a long time. I knew I was an unhappy drinker, but am I, a lot of my drinking stuff, I mentioned the drunk driving, but it's depression and isolation and depression and isolation and depression and isolation. That's my drinking story. And I would go to bars a lot, but the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde stuff and blackouts, and it was unsafe for me to be around a lot. Isolated, depressed, sad, cut off, a lot of that. So I asked this old-timer, "How do you know you're an alcoholic? How do I know I'm an alcoholic?" And he could have said, "Here's how you'll know," and give me the 97 questions or the 14 charts or the 12 photographs. And instead, what he said was, "Tom, I don't know if you're an alcoholic." He said, "I know I'm an alcoholic. And I know I'm an alcoholic," he said, "because I am not able to predict my behavior once I have my first drink." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "There are times I could drink a lot and nothing would happen. Completely uneventful. No crises, no drama. Other times I would drink just a little and anything could happen." and I never knew which one it was going to be. I had no way of predicting my behavior after my first drink. And therefore, he said, I conclude that I'm an alcoholic. Now, if that's the criterion, I identify. Once I start drinking, I don't know what's going to happen. A lot of the drunk driving and a lot of the other craziness is there. How did I get sober? Well, I didn't have a lot of problem with step one. Step one says powerless and unmanageable. And the way I understood it was that I was doomed and hopeless. I didn't think I had a little tiny problem that if I just tried hard enough I could overcome. I thought I was a dead man. I thought that there was no way out. I thought that I was completely trapped. And what I didn't know was that there was hope. I mentioned already a little bit of depression. Even genetically, there's reason to be depressed in my family. We're Irish Catholic Democrats on one side and Swedish Lutheran Republicans on the other. And neither one of those groups is known for whimsy, you know, or let's go have a good time. It's just bleak. So when my drinking was out of control and I was hopeless, I just felt doomed and I relaxed around it. And I rationalized a lot of that. When I was in college, I read all of the existentialists. I read them in English, not French, but nevertheless I read them. I occasionally would carry the French translations or the original French, you know, around with me, and people would think I was reading the French, but I wasn't. I just did that to impress. But I would read someone like Jean-Paul Sartre, and he was not a terribly social fellow, and he said, hell is other people. And I thought that was a keen insight. And I read Albert Camus. I read everything that Camus wrote. I loved Camus. I wrote his notebooks. I read his novels. Camus said at one point that the only serious philosophic 20th century is why not kill yourself. And I said, yes, this is someone who understands. And I can remember thinking about shooting myself a lot, killing myself, taking poison, jumping off roofs. And this is before alcohol is a problem, you understand. This is when I'd say 20, 21, 22 years old. And I would talk sometimes with other friends, developing a very dark sense of humor about the suicide stuff. But it was there. It was always there. There's another writer I liked, and his name is Franz Kafka. And Kafka is Jewish, and he's Prague, Czechoslovakia, that part of the world. And he writes in the 1920s, and his stuff becomes very popular in the 1930s. And the Germans are getting pretty enthusiastic and wild, and will be marching soon. So there was pressure. And Kafka writes about being trapped and no hope and no meaning and no purpose and no way out, and they're going to screw you anyway. And I said, yes, this is the story. And he has one line that says, there is infinite hope, but not for us. I love that. I brought that right into the way I thought and felt about everything, and I bring that into the program. So that when I start going to meetings, and I'm intervened on by members of my community, they see me drowning in booze. They know it's an illness, not a moral problem. They land on me, put me into treatment, and strongly suggest I also go to AA. That's the short version of the story. And that happened the day I was confronted, my first day without a drink, was the day that Gerald Ford was nominated for President of the United States, August 18th, 1976, if that doesn't come up right away for you. So I start coming to AA, and what I believe is this. The program is going to work for you guys. It's not going to work for me. See, there is infinite hope for you. But I'm too cynical. I'm too bent. I'm too badly wired. I am my own worst enemy. You are decent, hard-working people with some sincerity and integrity. I don't have any of that. So I'm going to hang around and maybe see how long I can stay without drinking, but it never occurred to me that I'd have a life. Joan Larkin writes a poem about getting sober, and she talks about being dry. She says, "This is unspeakable deprivation." Yeah, that's right. I didn't have my best friend. I didn't have a program. I was going to meetings, and that's where I learned a lot of stuff, and that's where I began picking up a little bit. But I didn't ever think that I'd have a life. I mean, what does a life look like anyway? I'm doomed. I'm hopeless. There's no way out for me. I'm very glad the program will work for you. Now, my experience is that if you hang out a lot with hopeful people who tell the truth, you will learn how to tell the truth and you will experience hope. It might be real slow. We call it by osmosis, by breathing it in. One day I was 6 months or 9 months or 10 months sober, and I was at a meeting, and I looked around the room, and I realized that I was not alone in the room. There were other people there. A. B. I'm in spiritual awakening. B. Anybody in the room is being touched by God's grace. Whatever that looks like and whatever it is. But anybody in the room has the contact. And that means that maybe I can get it too. Now, I didn't suddenly feel hopeful. And I discover that I don't need a whole bunch of hope. I mean, I've never had, you know, over 80% hope in my life. I consider myself a pessimist with a good attitude. You know, I don't suddenly burst into gratitude quickly. But I find that if I have over 11% hope, I remember to take action. And most of my life is between 11% and 80%. And I can make decisions and do the left foot, right foot stuff of showing up and sitting in a chair and raising my hand at a meeting and doing some kind of service and participating. That hopeful stuff that means just for today there's enough. And I'm not going to worry about tomorrow. And life started to get pretty rich for me. I saw a shrink. Many of us do. There are strong feelings about this. I have found, and this is my experience, some shrinks are really helpful. And some shrinks I like better than others. And it's nice to work with a shrink you like who knows a lot about the program. And I've worked with several fine people like that. But I was seeing a shrink, and I'm depressed, right? Blinding revelation. If you take large amounts of a depressant on a daily basis for years, you will get depressed. This is crucial to understand. And I had been drinking a huge amount of booze every day for years. Why am I so depressed? Couldn't have anything to do with your drinking, huh? I was talking to somebody and they were saying, well, the reason he drinks is he's depressed. I said, it makes no difference. You know, if he gets sober, we can deal with the depression later. But unless he gets sober, why depressed, down, doomed, hopeless, trashed. So I'm no longer drinking or using. You start waking up. You start coming to. I got sober. I was dry and I went into the hospital. I was 10 days without a drink. I went into the hospital for a program where they reintroduced me to food. Because who has time to eat? And they reintroduced me to hygiene, which was real important, and it still is. It's a good sign if you wash. And we were right next to the burn unit at Alta Bates Hospital. And the people who worked on our staff talked a little bit about people who are recovering from real bad burns. And they said if you've been burned real bad over a large portion of your body, you don't feel any pain because all the nerve endings have been burned off. Now you're in great danger of dying. You can go into shock. You can get infected. You're leaking. You have no skin. Things are very bleak, but you don't feel pain. So in the burn unit, they're just real sensitive about touching and infections and being watered enough. But you're okay. When the patient starts screaming and yelling about the pain, the staff knows the person's getting well. Because the nerve endings are growing back. And you suddenly start saying, "I hurt all over!" And the staff person will come and say, "This is a good sign. This means you're getting well. Be glad that you can hurt." Well, I'm coming out of the fog. I'm coming out of the numb. And what I start experiencing are painful things like emotions. Now, until that moment, my basic emotion was fine, thanks. Which meant I'm not feeling anything, leave me alone. And without the alcohol in my system and the non-habit forming marijuana, which I smoked every day for 10 years... which is another dandy depressant. Why are you so depressed? Well, you're smoking dope and drinking yourself unconscious every night. It must be your family. I started having all the emotions that are red and black. I mean, very dramatic, roller coaster stuff. Huge rushes of rage, anger, upset, screaming, yelling, swearing. I went to meetings where you could say, "Fuck a lot," you know. And people swearing and pounding. There was, and I'm, you know, uptight Northern European. We had one woman named Bonnie L., and she was a Jewish lady from the Bronx, and she was right. There was a whole bunch of us in our late 20s, early 30s who got sober within a year. Bonnie would come to meetings, and she would pound on the table and burst into tears and cry in front of everybody. And I realized, she's doing that for me. I couldn't ever do that. But I can be in the room with someone who's doing it, and it's almost as good, you know. And the emotional stuff started happening. And I remember I was sober a couple of years, and it was a big breakthrough when I was angry, and I realized I was angry at the same time. Red letter day. Red letter day. I was sober 5 years. I left L.A., moved back to Oakland, and I missed all my friends in Los Angeles. And I remember calling my sponsor, and I had this huge rush of loneliness. And I called Terry, and I said, "I'm so lonely." And he said, "Yes." I said, "Yes! Fix me!" And he said, "There's nothing to fix. You've left a lot of friends. You've moved to a new place. You're going to feel lonely. What should I do?" Well, make some phone calls, write some letters, talk to newcomers, talk to old-timers, stack chairs, and this will pass. It's a feeling. It's an emotion. It will pass. They come and they go. Really? I was about 10 years sober, and I started feeling sad and sadness and grief. It was a whole new world. Whole new world. And I find that walking through that, and I needed some outside help for that. I needed a little therapy, and I needed to do some intensive work and some family stuff. Walking through that, I found there are many, many emotions between the colors of red and black that are part of my life. I think it's hard being conscious. I think it's hard being sensitive. Things do come and go. The program gives me tools and companions to walk through this stuff with. It's real important. That first shrink I saw, I went, and so now emotions are coming up, and I'm starting to get angry a lot. And my two speeds seem to be huge amounts of rage and exhaustion. Huge amounts of rage and exhaustion. And I couldn't, I won't sleep for 3 days, then I'll sleep around the clock. And am I losing my mind? And I asked him on one occasion, I'm like 10 months sober, I said, Leonard, do you think I'm normal? And he looked at me with these wise Jewish eyes and he said, normal is 98.6. I said, what am I trying to say? He said, you're trying to say, am I healthy? Am I okay? And I said, yeah, okay. Am I okay? Am I healthy? And he said, well, a healthy person is able to do three kinds of things. Healthy people can work. Healthy people can love. Healthy people can play. If you know someone who can work, love, and play, you know a pretty healthy person. And I said, go on. And I was hoping he'd use other words. And I said, he said, well, like the work stuff. In the state of California, there's this ridiculous law that says if the kids are in the classroom, you should be there too. If you're a teacher, you know. And I was pretty good on that most of the time, but I wasn't steady when I was drinking. I had to learn how to work again sober. I was sober a year, and I went back to the classroom, and my second year of sobriety was the most difficult year of my life. The skin had not yet grown back over the burned areas. And I had no defenses and no protection and no credit. I didn't think I could do this. I felt so stupid, and I felt so dumb, and I felt so thick and so slow, and how can I survive with a room full of kids 5 times a day, 5 days a week? And it was awful. I went to a meeting every night. I hit a therapist once a week. I had to talk to other teachers. And sometimes what those teachers did, I was so full of fear in my second year of sobriety. It only happened once or twice, but it happened. Another teacher had to walk me to the classroom, let me go inside, stay outside the classroom. When the class was over, he'd get me and take me back to the teacher's room, full of fear. But there were people who were willing to walk through that night. But it was irrational, but very real. You know? And I had to relearn how to do everything. That's right, I had to learn how to work again. Some of us, when we're sober a little bit, find out that jobs we could do loaded, we can't do sober. And we change careers. I sponsored a guy like this named Charlie. I was now into my, you know, way into my mega years of sobriety. Charlie ran a garage in Berkeley. And it was, I got to Berkeley in 81, and I said, where is there an honest garage? Charlie's garage! So I took my car to Charlie's, and Charlie was great with cars and all this other stuff, and lots of program people took their cars to Charlie's garage. And then one day, after doing that for 4 or 5 or 7 years, Charlie shows up at a meeting. And he finds out that half the room are his clients. Which flips him out. We thought that our bumper stickers got him sober, but we don't know that. And he was embarrassed, but we said, we love you, come on. And anyway, Charlie stays sober, and then he asks me to be his sponsor, and, you know, my sponsor, the mechanic, or my sponsee, the mechanic. So I am talking to him over coffee one day about what life means, and Charlie's almost 50 years old at the time, and he says, you know, I'm just tired of being a mechanic. I want to do something else. I said, how did you become a mechanic? He said, when I was 16 years old, I started playing with cars in the backyard. I don't want to do that anymore. I'm tired of working with my hands. I want to go back to school and wear a tie and have a job with a roof over. And my first thought was, where will I take my car? It's So I said, Charlie, you shouldn't rush this decision, you know. Let's take a long time. But he changed careers. It took him about 2 years. He did it right. He sold stuff. He went to school. He wears a tie. He's very happy. He's got a job he loves. When I was newly sober, 2-3 years sober, I started meeting all kinds of ex-teachers at meetings who did not find it possible or happy to stay sober teaching in the classroom. And I first just stayed away from them because I wanted to find sober teachers, you know, to kind of encourage me. And when I was 5 years sober, I left teaching. It just didn't fit anymore, and I went into social work, and I did that for 3 years. But a lot of us change careers. Fine. Working, loving. It's all about relationships. And I probably don't need to say this because we're older and more mature, but when you're talking to immature people, sometimes you have to point out that there's a lot more to loving than getting laid. Some of us have been sexual with people we would not have coffee with. And when we're talking about relationships, loving, we're talking about reconnecting with family, reconnecting with friends, reconnecting with all kinds of people. It's that whole wide world of acquaintances and friends and kith and kin and how to develop. I didn't know how to be your friend unless we were using together. If we drank in the same bar, I thought we were bosom buddies. If we drank the same brand, I thought we had something in common. And I was a couple of years sober, and feelings were emerging. I'm finding out I'm starting to like some people very much, and I have no idea what to do with that. I mean, what do I do with that? Do I tell them? You know? I really like you. You know? I'm 3 years sober, and I really like you. And it's taken a while. I found part of the loving is trusting, crucial part of the loving. The first person I trusted on the program was my sponsor, Terry, and he had been my sponsor for over a year, and I'd been watching him carefully for over a year before I decided that I could trust this man. And after that, after I could trust one person, there's more than one person I can trust. I found I started being able to love a few people, not just like them, and it opens up a whole new world. Loving. And then playing. How do you recreate? How do you feed your own soul? How do you do things that nourish you so that you can work and maintain friendships? I didn't know what I liked when I got sober. I liked to be drunk. What do you like for music? What do you like for theater? What do you like for color? Do you like the beach? I don't know. The shrink, Leonard, the shrink said, "Why don't you go to the beach sober?" Well, I went with a group. There were five of us, all newly sober. We were completely clothed. We stood at the beach and looked around. We didn't know how to do this. And I went back and said, "Well, we went." And he said, "Did you like it?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "Keep going back until you find out if you like it or not." I found out that I have very strong likes and dislikes, and it's been lots of trial and error, but over the last 20 plus years, I've learned how to do some play. One of my friends knows a lot about music, a lot about music. He's even an official critic, you know, writes for papers, and he gets 2 tickets for things. And so I'm sometimes his date if it's in Oakland. He'll call and say, "You free tonight?" So we go, and a couple of years ago, there's a jazz club in Oakland called Yoshi's, and I don't know anything about jazz. I like some real simple stuff, but there's a Cuban piano player they finally led into the United States, and he was playing at Yoshi's, and Tim had a couple of tickets. Tim's also on the program. We went. Now, what I noticed, the club is full of people. These people are clearly people who are passionate about jazz. And they love what this guy's doing. I don't get what he's doing at all. And I realize I'm glad to be here. I'm glad I can see something that is real high quality stuff. And I have so much to learn. I'd go again just to learn some more because I don't know so many things. If I was drinking, he never would have called. I never would have gone. I never would have experienced a wonderful evening of music. Sober, we get to learn things. I've even seen the Moody Blues sober, which is an experience. Working, loving, playing. I find that slowly over time, if I do the footwork, I've got a human life. And human beings work, love, and play. Let me say one or two more real simple things and then end so we can get on with our lives here. I heard someone say that in your first year of sobriety, you deal with physical things, and your second year of sobriety, you deal with emotional things, and your third year of sobriety, you deal with spiritual things. And I guess then you die. I'm not sure. I found that real important information when I was 2 years sober, but now that I'm a little older, I think that rule of thumb, that description, was drawn up by somebody with 4 years. And it's good, but I mean, it's 4 years. My experience has been that my first 10 years were physical, and my second 10 years were emotional. And I'm hoping to fall into spirituality any day now. But I'm in the next thing. I have drinking dreams. I had one just last month. And these really threw me when I first started having them because I didn't understand them. And I thought if you dream about it, you must really want it, you know. And so if I'm drinking it, is something, if I'm dreaming about drinking, should I do another fifth step was my question. But I didn't want to tell people that I was having drinking dreams because, you know what happens at meetings if you show vulnerability. People line up and tell you what you should do. So I waited until I was alone with my sponsor, and I didn't want to tell him I was having, because I didn't trust him yet. I said, hypothetically, what does it mean if someone in another state is having drinking dreams? And he said, have you had the one yet? And then he told me a drinking dream that he had, which was very perverted. And I recoiled as if from a hot flame and said, oh no, I haven't had that disgusting flavor to my drinking dreams. And then about 6 months later, I did. It was the dream where you're in the dream, you know you've been going to meetings for a long time, but you've been drinking secretly the whole time. And you're in the room by yourself drinking, and it's time to go to a meeting. I've had that dream. I've had a dream where I was in my car drinking and driving. Southern Comfort was in the rider's seat in a paper brown paper bag, and I'd reach over and take a hit out of it, and then I'd put it down driving. Now, I never did that. I drove drunk. But I never drank and drove. Just to make that clear. I'm a higher quality of alcoholic. And in the dream, I'm drinking and driving, and I suddenly realize that I'm speaking at a meeting that night. And my only concern is I wonder if they'll smell it. Those are very troubling dreams. I was 10 years sober. I had a drinking dream so vivid that when I woke up the next morning, I knew I had lost 10 years. And it was maybe the second or third cup of coffee, and I realized I had not gone out. It was such a relief. Well, I asked Terry, what does this stuff mean? And he says, well, drinking dreams mean that for us, our drinking has become a nightmare. That's number one. And number two, he said, people who have drinking dreams don't get drunk. He said, did you ever have a drinking dream when you were drinking? Only sober people get them. Very strange. I go off caffeine every so often as I go into the new Puritanism, you know, and I let me get off food and be really pure. I went off caffeine a couple times, and one of these, I had this caffeine dream where someone ran up to me with a bowl of French roast, and I took it and ran into the back room and drank it by myself. So it's strange. And the last thing to say is I really do believe in this day at a time thing. I find when I don't drink just for today, I have life and hope and some humor and levity in my life. When I think about I can never drink again for as long as I live, all the joy goes out of my life. And so this is day at a time, and I think of drinking. Regularly through my brain, I think of drinking. And what do I do about it? I don't drink today. If it gets real repetitive, I say, Tom, you can drink tomorrow. And that takes enough of the edge off that I don't drink today. A year ago Christmas, I was driving across the Bay Bridge from San Francisco into Oakland. And they took one of these big billboards. And Chevy's restaurant did this. And it was cranberry margaritas. I had never thought about cranberry margaritas. Until that moment. And I suddenly needed a cranberry margarita so badly that I almost pulled the car into oncoming traffic. And it wouldn't go away. I mean, I needed a cranberry margarita. Whenever I wasn't doing anything else, I was thinking about a cranberry margarita. So whoever did that ad for Chevy's has my number. And I talked about it at meetings and joked about it. I finally went to a restaurant, not Chevy's, and had a virgin cranberry margarita, and I've never had to have a second one. But for a while, it was right there. Well, what does that mean? It means I'm an alcoholic. And that's the way my brain is wired. And the wiring is not going to change just because I'm embarrassed by it. Therefore, I need a regular program of action that enables me to live clean and sober. I've got to go to meeting because I forget within 4 minutes, you know. I was out with my friend Annie at a movie once, and she turned to me and said, "Do we drink?" I said, "I don't think so. I'll ask my sponsor. I'm not sure." And the simple, you know, what do you do? Say hello to newcomers, say hello to old timers, stack chairs, go to meetings. I find when I do that, my life is much better. In my spiritual tradition, the Jesuit thing kicks in the mid-1500s, and the man that founds the Jesuits is convinced of a couple of things, and one of the things he's convinced of is God is at work. God is at work. That's number one. And number two, if you are grateful for the work that God does, if you are truly grateful, then you're willing to be of service. Gratitude is not about emotion. Gratitude is about service. And there are thousands of ways of being of service. My sponsor was talking to a newcomer. I was across the room talking to someone else, boring. And I was eavesdropping on what my sponsor was saying to the newcomer. And the newcomer asked my sponsor if my sponsor was, you know, "Are you surprised that you're this sober?" Because Terry's sober 28 or 9 years or something like that. Something ridiculous. And he's a desperate alcoholic. Desperate alcoholic. Who, if he wasn't going to meetings and staying sober, he'd be chained to some hospital bed, naked, howling at the moon. I mean, I'm just convinced of it to my bones. So the young man said, "Are you surprised you're sober this long?" And Terry said, "Oh, no, I'm not surprised I'm sober." He said, "I've been sober before." He in and out of a lot of treatment places. "Oh," he said, "I've been sober before." He said, "I'm not surprised I'm sober. I'm surprised. I'm grateful I'm sober." I mean, that's the gift. It's not just, "I'm not drinking."
But to be grateful to not be drinking. And because of that, being willing to be of service in some kind of way on this planet is a great gift. AA is a program full of people who have enabled me to learn how to live a life again. And I'm real grateful for that and glad to be here in Roseville on Saturday night. Happy anniversary.